The Torah says that Sori Menu lived Meya Shana, the Esrim Shana, the Sheva Shana. Rashi says when she was 100, she was as if she was 20, Legabe Sin. In those days, you really weren't 100% responsible for heavenly decrees until you were 100, because people lived longer time. And, today is 20. Then it was 100. Right. What? No. She was at Meya, like Esrim Lechet, right. All right, okay, yeah, okay. But the truth is that was before, the 100 was before that, was the time of Noah. Right? But until 20, a person is not held responsible for heavenly things. And she was at 100, as pure from chait as she was when she was 20. And she was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. So, two things. First of all, I can understand that the Torah wants to tell us how pure Sara Imenu was from sin. But what difference does it make how pretty she was? And if she was an ugly hag, she would have been less of a Sara Imenu. What difference does it make? Why does the Torah go out of its way to tell us the beauty of Sara Imenu? And also, what does that mean? She was as beautiful at 20 as at 7, right? Lechora, a 20-year-old is prettier than a 7-year-old. So some say that the idea is that but it's at 20, it's telling you the different stages in her life. So it says at 100, she was as pure from sin as at 20. As 20, she was as beautiful as she was at 7.
But she was already 127. What's the difference?
Yeah, okay, fine, whatever.
I thought it had to do with that 127 she was also...
No, that doesn't know what it says. It says, I don't know what's it called, but it says that the only thing it tells us is 20 to 7. Okay. So the question is, why does the Torah go out of its way to tell us that? Who cares? And also, is a 20-year-old less pretty than a 7-year-old? It just seems the opposite. So some say that a 7-year-old is becoming prettier and prettier, whereas a 20-year-old already is... on the way down. But so she was as pretty as 20 as at 7. Okay, in any case, the answer is the following, I think, one of the answers. We find that the Torah does attribute a lot of importance to beauty, both for men and for women. It tells us how Yosef was handsome, tells us that Rivka was handsome, and Rachel, and obviously, it makes a difference, otherwise the Torah wouldn't mention it. The Vilna Gaon says on the Pasuk, Sheker Hachein Vehevel Hayofi, Isha Yiras Hashem Yitesalu. He says that when is charm and beauty vain and false? When there's nothing more. When it's purely external. Then it's meaningless. But in a woman who fears Hashem, she should be praised for her beauty and her charm. Then there is a value in beauty and charm also where it reflects the inner beauty. The basic idea is that we live in a world where we are affected by externals, by what we see. And therefore we do mitzvahs in a very aesthetically appealing way that represents and externally gives us a feeling of the inner holiness of the mitzvah. We have beautiful mitzvahs. We beautify the mitzvahs. Same thing goes with a person who inside is beautiful because of his midos, because of his yiras shamayim. And when you look at that person, you want to have an external feeling of getting a message of that internal beauty. And that's why it says she was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. The beauty of a 20-year-old is a very subjective, culturally influenced thing. Right? What's considered beautiful in one culture is not beautiful in another culture. Right? Some cultures, the heavier the woman is, the more beautiful she is. In some cultures, women go on terrible diets because being heavy doesn't make you beautiful. The opposite. The example I always like to give, I'm sure I've given this in the past here, is the Ubangis, right? Right, they put a half saucer in their daughter's lips as they mature, until when they're mature young women, their upper lip sticks out about a foot. That's called vig. And that's considered beautiful. If you don't have a upper lip that sticks out a foot, you're never going to find a shidduch amongst the Ubangis. On the other hand, if you have a daughter who has upper lip sticks out a foot, right, you send her to the orthodontist, spend thousands of dollars to correct it, otherwise she'll never find a shidduch. So I had a daughter who needed orthodonture work. I was thinking of sending her to the Ubangis. It would have been cheaper than the orthodonter work, but the shidduchim over there were a little too black for me. I couldn't resist that. In any case. No, I was just... that was just a pun. It wasn't to be taken literally. In any case, so the beauty of a seven-year-old is not that kind of culturally subjective beauty, but it's the beauty of youth, innocence, that's universal. That is the beauty that Sora Imenu exuded at 22, when she was 20. She radiated an outer appearance, manifestation of her inner beauty. That's the beauty we're talking about. And that the beauty, the Torah says, is significant. It's important to be able to see externally what exists internally, spiritually. Okay. Then the Torah goes on and says, Shnei Chayi Sara, sums them all up, and Rashi says, Kulam Shovim Latova. They all were equally for the good. So we've always said in the past, I'm just going to mention it, that it doesn't say they all were equally good, because they weren't. The 90 years she was barren wasn't as good as the year she had Yitzchak. The night she was dragged to Paro where Avimelech wasn't as good as the day she celebrated Yitzchak's bris. You can't say they all were equally good, but it doesn't say that. It says, Kulam Shovim Litov. They all were equally for the good. In other words, Sara Imenu made the best of every situation, and she channeled it and used it for the good. No matter how bad the situation was or how good the situation was, Sara Imenu found a way of channeling it towards the good. With that, I always like to explain the Medrash. We have other ways of explaining this Medrash, which we've mentioned here. But the simplest way of explaining this Medrash is the following. The Medrash says in the beginning of this week's Sedra, Rabbi Akiva was giving a drasha, and the students started to fall asleep. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. And he wanted to wake them up. So he said to them, what did Esther see that enabled her to rule over 127 provinces? Let Esther, the great-great-granddaughter of Sara, who lived 127 years, rule over 127 provinces. So they all woke up. What in the world is there a connection between Sara's 127 years and Esther's 127 provinces, except for the same number? And Rabbi Akiva went on. What was the message here? I think the message was, Rabbi Akiva was telling his students the following. It's hard to stay up for a shiur, right? As soon as somebody starts to speak, your eyes get heavy. I know that's the way I am when I'm listening. When I'm talking, it's a different story. When I'm on that end, as soon as the guy starts, all of a sudden I get this terrible sleepiness over, right, overcome me, and it's very hard to stay awake, to keep awake. So Rabbi Akiva said, I understand that. But, you know, Sara Imenu had a pretty difficult life. But she was able to control and channel every moment to be in total control. And everything she used for the good. Esther Hamalka also had a pretty miserable life, if you think about it. She was taken away from her husband, Mordechai, taken away from the Jewish people, forced to be the queen of Persia, which is not exactly her greatest, you know, dream, right? All her Yiddish and Nachas was taken away from her. She had a child, Koresh, who considered himself a Persian, not a Jew. So here's her Yiddish and Nachas. My son is the king of Persia. Right? Not exactly Esther's big dream. Yet, she was able to persevere, overcome all of that, and rule it for the good, and end up saving the Jewish people. So what do you see from that? That it's possible to overcome and control difficult situations. If they can control their situations, you can stay up. And you can control it. Yeah, it's difficult. But that's what Rabbi Akiva was telling his Talmidim. Okay, next. Avram Avinu sends Eliezer to get a wife for Yitzchak, not from Haknani Ashirani Yoshe Bekirbo, not from the Knani around, just send to my family. Question is, what was so great about Avram Avinu's family? They were idol worshippers, right? Were not really, you know, the most honest people. They were pretty despicable people. What did Avram Avinu see that his family was better? So there are many answers to this, and they're all true. One is that the Knanim, even the best of them, there are always exceptions. Eliezer was a fine Talmud Chacham, but Canaan was cursed. They had a curse on them, and that curse could take effect at any time. There could be exceptions, but then the next generation, the curse will come back. It was something, it's like having some kind of genetic disease. Right? You have a family that has a genetic disease, and there's somebody who didn't catch. Right? Genetically, they were a recessive gene, whatever, they didn't catch the thing. But there's always a danger the next generation is going to come out. So Avraham Avinu said, my family, they may not be all that great, but there's exceptions. And there's no reason to assume that what my family is now, and the exception is good, that the next generation won't be good. But if there's a curse hovering over a family, like the Canaanim, who knows what's going to be in the future also. That was one reason. Ein orer mizdabik bebaruch. And that's why he didn't want even Eliezer to marry her, his daughter, because the curse is there. The truth is that after Eliezer was so selfless that he didn't let the fact that he had a daughter that he wanted to marry to Yitzchak interfere with his shlichus, the curse went away from him. He was completely purified of that curse. He became the real exception to the Canaan. But it didn't happen until he selflessly married her to somebody else. Second idea is that it has nothing to do with how good or bad Avraham Avinu's family was or the Canaanim. They could have been equally good or equally bad. The problem was that Avraham Avinu dwelt amongst the Canaanim. And if he found a wife for Yitzchak from close by, she would be influenced by her parents. They'd go to spend one Shabbos here and a Shabbos there or whatever, and Yitzchak would be influenced by their side of the family, which all of the Canaanim were not exactly the greatest righteous people. And there, but if he took her from far away, from his family, right, then the chances of her ever going back to be influenced by her family were almost nil. And therefore Avram knew, I could have complete influence and she won't be influenced by the other side of the family. So it wasn't Avraham Avinu's family was anything intrinsically different than the Canaanim, it's just the closeness of the Canaanim and the father being farther away of the family of this girl. Okay, that's another idea. A third idea, they say, is there was nobody that was really fit the way they were to be Yitzchak's wife. Avraham was going to have to take somebody who had potential and build her up. And Yitzchak would build her up and she would grow into the family. So that means Avram was going to have to inspire and influence somebody. So he said, why should I influence and inspire a stranger when I can influence and inspire somebody from my family? I mean, just like you have to give tzedakah to your family before anybody else, you have to give spiritual tzedakah to your family too. And if I'm going to have to influence somebody, then I might as well take somebody from my family. That was another idea. The Ran says another idea. He says that Avraham Avinu's family... before I go to the Ran, because I want to speak a little bit. Another idea is, if he took a girl from Canaan, later on when Bnei Yisrael got Eretz Yisrael, people would say they didn't get Eretz Yisrael because of Yitzchak's side. They got it because of the wife's side. So he didn't want anyone to ever think that Eretz Yisrael was given to us because we inherited it from the Canaanim, but rather we were given it by the Ribono Shel Olam. So he didn't want a Canaani involved in the family. Okay. Another idea is that there was a decree made already prophetically, Ger Yezaracha Beretz Lolohem, that for 400 years we were going to go through a state of being strangers in a land that's not ours, and for a portion of that being enslaved and being tortured, oppressed. How much of that time was given up by being strangers, and then slavery? The slavery itself was only 210 years that we were actually in Mitzrayim. So 190 of those years started in Eretz Israel. From the time that Yitzchak was born, he was a stranger in a land that wasn't his, because the land belonged to the Canaanim and not to our not to the family of Avram at the time. Had Yitzchak married a Canaani, then he couldn't never be considered a stranger in a land that wasn't his, because it belonged to his wife. It's part of their inheritance at the time. So then this prophecy could not have started from the birth of Yitzchak, or at least from the time that Yitzchak got married. Therefore, to obviate that, Avraham made sure not to marry Yitzchak to a Canaan. The Ran says, which I really want to speak about, and not at great length, but at some length, the Ran says that there was a significant difference between Avraham Avinu's family and the Canaanim. The Canaanim had bad midos. They had bad character. Character is something that can span generations. The bad character of parents can be given over to the children almost genetically. Masha Einkein, I have somebody now that's asked for advice or whatever, they want to adopt a child, but the child that's up for adoption has many children that are up for adoption and have a problem from problem families. And the father is a definite schizophrenic, and the mother, they're not sure if she's a schizophrenic, and she has genetic, you know, what's it called, information that the chances of having a schizophrenic child, right, of anybody getting schizophrenia is like 1%. But if you have one schizophrenic parent, the chances are somewhere between 10 and 25%. If you have two schizophrenic parents, it goes up to 30 to 50% chance that the child will be schizophrenic. So if you want to know what you should do or whatever, interesting thing. But you see that certain character disorders can be given over genetically, and even they can't be given over physically genetically, but spiritually genetically. So Avraham Avinu was concerned that if I marry my son to a woman who may be beautiful and in her character, but she may be beautiful in her character, but she's carrying these spiritual genes from her parents, from grandparents, that she was that are bad character. So it may show up in two generations, three generations, because character flaws can be passed on. But my family, Avraham said, they're not bad characters. They just have bad philosophy, bad ideology. They're idol worshippers. Bad philosophies don't go on genetically. That's something that everybody gets on their own. You don't inherit bad philosophies. You taught them, you're educated with them, but you could be re-educated. But when we're talking about behavior, character, which is can be transmitted almost genetically, that's a bigger problem. That's what the Ran says. Very nice. But it doesn't seem like that fits Avraham's family. Avraham's family were not just people who were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. They were pretty despicable people. Lavan Ha'arami, he was a Rami. He was a liar, a cheat. That doesn't seem to be only problems of ideology. Seems to be problems of character. They were real characters. So, what's the Ran saying? It's a nice idea, but how does it apply over here? How could the Ran say that Avraham Avinu's family were not bad characters, only bad ideology? Very difficult, Ron. What I think the answer is the following. Just as much as we explained a few weeks ago, that good character is not something that you just behave nicely, because even an animal can be trained to behave nicely. But it means that you've worked on your character and basically are in total control. That's really good character traits. Good behavior, can stay and last until the first mouse goes by, right, and you get down on all fours. Right, the story we said with the trained cats. You can train a cat to be a waiter, but you can't change its instincts. A cat can't change its character. It always has the character of a cat, the instincts. You can train it to temporarily bypass that, but you can't train it to totally change its instincts. So what does it depend on? The cat can be trained to think it's a waiter until the mouse goes by, and then the instincts are triggered. Right? It goes down on all four. But a human being can create a different character, different behavior completely. Not just behave nicely, but change his entire character, build your character, be in control. Okay. That's on the positive side. The opposite is also true. There's also bad behavior, but it's not that it comes from bad character, it just comes from no character. In other words, you never worked on your midos for the good, and you never worked on them for the bad, so you're basically an animal that's waiting for a mouse to go by. If the mouse goes by, you get down on all four. If the mouse doesn't go by, you can be a very nice person. It's not that you have bad midos when the mouse goes by, it's just that you have no midos. Avraham Avinu's family didn't have bad midos. They didn't have any midos. And therefore they were subject to the influence of the people around them. In fact, the Kli Yoker says that every time it says, or most of the time I guess, Lavan hu arami, it says Mipadan aram. Lavan hu arami mipadan aram. Why does he have to say it all the time? He's Lavan hu arami mipadan aram. Says the Kli Yoker to tell me that the reason that he was a cheat and a liar wasn't because intrinsically that's how he developed his character. He was influenced by the people around him. He was from Padan Aram, from all the people around him. That's the way they lived. They all were cheats and liars. That was the way of life. So he was basically influenced by the people around him. Not so, however, that he ingrained within himself these ideas by really working on himself in a negative way. The Knanim, on the other hand, engendered in themselves really bad midos. They weren't just people who didn't have any character and just did whatever came naturally. And Mamela, a lot of times the mice came by and they were on all fours. But they did things that didn't come naturally. I'll give you two examples. Okay, the Knanim, the Gemara says, I mean, these were the people that God said had to be annihilated, men, women, and children, because they were a blight on the world. To give you an idea of what they were, they weren't just not nice people. When they had old parents who were no longer productive, so they didn't hire a Filipino or send them to an assisted living facility, right? They made use of their parents in a very productive way. They fed them to their dogs. Took them outside. They had pit bull, all these vicious dogs, and the dogs needed a meal. And they saved themselves a meal by feeding their parents to the dogs. So the parents were productive in providing a meal for the dogs, and they no longer were a problem of being around the house and getting in the way. You have to really work on your midos to be able to feed your parents to the dogs. Right? That doesn't come naturally just because you're not a person who's in control of your good character. You have to really develop a bad character for that. Or on the other end of the spectrum, in order to have success in life with their children, whatever, they held that sacrificing their children to Molech would bring success with the remaining children and with their financial position or whatever. So they used to sacrifice their children to Molech. Now that on the surface seems very cruel, but we imagine what it means is they brought their child and they slit their throat and they burnt them on an altar, which is pretty bad, but that's not what happened. Right? That would have been something that you could understand, perhaps, sometimes with your children, you could understand why somebody would. But it went beyond that. The way that they sacrificed a child to Molech was they had a fire, and they had the father would stand on one side, and the priest of the Molech would stand on the other side of the fire, and they would hand the child over the fire, slowly roasting it, until it was completely dead. Not in one spot. They didn't kill the kid. They roasted him slowly alive over this fire. Now again, you have to really work on your midos to ingrain cruelty to be able to do something like that. You can't just do that because you don't have good character. You have to do that because you have bad character. That's what the Ran meant. The Knanim had bad character. That's something that genetically can be transmitted. Spiritual genetics. Lavan didn't have bad character. He didn't have any character. He basically had bad ideology, never worked on his character, never felt it was important. So Memele, he was a cheat and a liar. But he never worked on it, that it became ingrained in him, and therefore it wouldn't pass on to future generations. I think that's what the Ran means. Okay.
A description for Rachel and Leah as opposed to Rivka.
That what?
Rivka, Rachel was a brother.
Yeah.
If he takes him on any traits, that might have been more of a trace that would appear for Rachel and Leah, who, you know, that Rachel was a cop.
But Pesuel also was no great chicks.
And that's a, and the other question I wanted to say was that he gives a few times the lineage for Rivka. That's Pesuel. Why Dafka then for Rivka? Because that's one of the matriarchs. To give that lineage, is that something that's connected with what I was saying?
Could be. Mm-hmm. That and that's why Rivka had Esav. Because what's it called? Because of her lineage. And Rachel and Leah Lemaisa, by the time it came through them, right, they were already free of that problem. It weaned out already. But yeah, it could be. It says, in fact, because we want to know who Aim Yasov was, because part of it was this genetics. Could be. Okay. Next. Eliezer tests Rivka with chesed. Is she capable of being a kind person? Right? Kindness. Right? Chesed, that's I guess how they translate chesed. He didn't bother to find out if she's from, right? If she stacks her dishes or doesn't, and what she wears on Shabbos, and what kind of color. The important things he didn't get into. Just was she a balas chesed? What?
You need a white
tablecloth. I'm saying, I once got a call about a boy from my yeshiva. Some mother called me that the shidduch had been talked about with this boy, and she asked me the most inane questions I ever heard in my life. Right, things that had really nothing to do with anything, but these were like the important things in her life to know about this boy. Right, I don't think she even cared if he was Jewish. But as long as he had a white tablecloth on Shabbos, that was, or something like that. It wasn't that, but I'm saying that was, you know, that's the. So in the middle of the conversation, I told the woman, I said, look, there's no purpose of continuing this conversation because I'm going to tell this boy not to touch your family with a 10-foot pole because somebody who has these kind of concerns or whatever is off the wall. So I would suggest that the next time a shidduch comes up, you think twice before you ask these kind of questions. That was the end of that conversation. What? So, I have a lot of people don't like me, but in any case, that's, I'm sure, one of them. The but really, I have no idea. But by the middle of the cycle, I was getting sick to my stomach to listen to this. Somebody had to let this woman know that this is not right. And I did that in a very, was somewhat diplomatic, but she got the message. In any case, so Eliezer, never really found out too much about the girl, except is she kind? Right? Well, she gave me a drink of water and my camels. Why was that? You know, maybe she doesn't believe in God. How did he know that, you know? So we've spoke about this in the past in great detail, just in a nutshell. A person who can be objective pretty much will believe in God. It's only people who are very subjective and biased and only see the world through their needs don't see God. They say that the difference between a mirror and a window, Through a window you see the whole world, and through a mirror you just see yourself. What's the difference? A little kesef, a little silver on the window makes you only see yourself. If you only are influenced by your own needs, you only see yourself, you won't see God. Where you're able to be objective, you look at the world, you'll see there's a God. You'll see God everywhere. So a girl who can divest herself of her own interests and think about somebody else, that's why chesed and emunah go together. It says whoever does chesed, it's like they believe in all the miracles that God did. And if you don't do chesed, like you don't believe. Because belief is dependent on being objective. And chesed means that you can think about somebody else and not just yourself. It always bothered me, if he wanted to test her, why did he ask her for a drink? He should have stood there with his tongue hanging out and see if she would offer him a drink. But after I grew up, the question didn't bother me anymore. Because the reality is that if you let somebody offer to do you a chesed, it's much easier for them than if you ask them for it. When somebody offers a chesed, they feel, I initiated this, and it's my thing, and you don't really feel good about it. But if somebody comes and asks you to do something for them, right away your feeling is, why should I do that for them, right? Who do they think they're asking? Who do they think they are to ask? And you have a million reasons not to do it. So Eliezer really wanted to see if she's about, so he asked her to give him a drink. And then she not only gave him the drink, she did even more and gave for the camels. Now in that, Eliezer changed the story. When it actually happened, so he said to her, give me to drink. She gave him to drink. When he finished drinking, she said, now I'll give you the camels. When he told over the story, he didn't tell it like that. He said, I asked her for a drink, and she said, I'll give you the drink and your camels. And then he drank, and she gave the camels. Why did he change it? So I was thinking, the reason is like this. It says that tzaddikim say a little bit and do a lot. Rishoyim promise you the world and end up not doing a lot. The Telzer Rosh Hashiva in Shurei Das explains, it's not that Rishoyim are liars and they promise you the world like politicians and they never intended to do anything. That's not the idea. The idea is the following. A righteous person knows that he has limitations. He knows he has the Yetzer Hara. He knows that there are trials and tribulations in this world that can prevent him from doing what he wants. So he can't promise you the world. He recognizes his limitations. He recognizes his Yetzer Hara. So he promises a little, but because he anticipates the problems, he's able to overcome them. And he does a lot. The Rasha doesn't think he has any limitations. He doesn't recognize he has the Yetzer Hara. So he promises you a lot, thinking he'll do it. And then because he doesn't anticipate the problems, the smallest little thing makes him fall. He can't overcome. The littlest problem already puts him out of commission. So, therefore, the difference in world and how you approach life is significant to a Rosh and a Tzaddik. Eliezer wanted to get across to the family that their sister and daughter was really somebody special. So in the lexicon of Tzaddikim, how did she show she was special? She promised a little. She said, I'll give you a drink. When she finished that, she went on to more. That's in the lexicon of a Tzaddik, that's really something special. Say a little and do a lot. But in the lexicon of a Rasha, that's not a big deal. A Rasha says, promise the world. Right? Not because you're a liar, because do a lot for first people. Not realizing that they're limited, but do a lot for the person. So if Eliezer would have told them, hey, your sister's really special, your daughter's special, she did like this, they would say, what's special about her? Why didn't she promise a lot? So it's like a person who has audio dyslexia, it's a disease I made up. Dyslexia is where you see things backwards. Audio dyslexia is where you hear things backwards. I say yes, you hear no. I say no, you hear yes. My kids had that when they were growing up. So that's called audio dyslexia, okay? If somebody who has that disease, you know they have that disease, says to you, is it nighttime now? What do you have to say to them? No. If you say yes, you're lying. Because you know that your yes in their ears is no. So you have to say no, and then you know that it's in their ears, they hear it as yes. It's exactly what Eliezer did. If I'll tell you that Rivka promised a little and did a lot, That means she's a great girl, but that's in the tzaddik mode. But if you want to hear it in the Russia mode, you have to change it around. Because they hear the message in the entire different way. So the message you wanted to bring across was true, but the only way you could bring it across to them was by inverting it. So therefore, that's true. Right? To tell Lavan and Besuel, she promised a little but did a lot. But this idea of anticipating problems is a true. If I have a boy who comes to me and he wants to know if he's ready to get married, and I say, okay, what are you going to do, you know, for Parnassa? So I'm going to sit and learn. I said, but yeah, you know, what they pay in a kol is not going to put food on your table for more than maybe 10 minutes or whatever, so what exactly are you going to do? So if he tells me, well, my wife is going to work and I'm going to tutor and we're going to, and we have bitachon that the Rabbanu Shlomo will help, maybe he's ready. But I have guys who tell me, no problem, right? God will take care or whatever. That's not a big mind, man. That's an idiot. Right? He has no idea of his problems. Avraham Friedman once told me a good fort, and if you remember it. It says that in Shemitah, if you ask, what are we going to do? We haven't planted, right? We haven't harvested. What are we going to eat after Shemitah? So God will give you a bracha that will give you enough in the sixth year for 3 years. So the question is, what if you don't ask? If you don't ask any questions, what reward do you get then? So there's all different answers in the Rishonim. Avraham Friedman said, if you don't ask any questions, you don't get any bracha, because you're an idiot. But it means you don't have a big maimon. You don't don't think there's any problem. If you don't think there's any problem, then there's no bitachon, there's no emunah. Right? It's only if you realize there's a problem, and then you say, despite that, I believe. But if you don't think there's any problem, you don't deserve a bracha. You deserve to have your head examined. Right? But that's the, I say it all the time in your name. Huh? No, I said it years ago in Matit Yar. I remember in the old Gan Shul. It's a great word. I say it over in your name all the time. It's Emes. Somebody who doesn't recognize his problems isn't any big mind. It's only if you recognize the problems, and despite that, you have emunah. So that's why Eliezer had to change it. He had to get the message across. The message was true, but the way to convey it was different if you're talking to a tzaddik, if you're talking to a Russian. And therefore, he wasn't lying. He just was saying, like audio dyslexia, he was saying what he knew would be heard in their ears that would get the message. If he said it the other way, it wouldn't be heard in their ears. That's not a lie. That's how you convey the truth.